First case on our docket this morning is Holiday Retirement Corp. v. Division of Industrial Relations. I see counsel are present. If they are ready to begin, please do so. Please state your name. If you wish to reserve any time, please state how much time you wish to reserve.
My name is Nancy Humboldt. I am an appellant counsel from Lewis, Brisbois, Biscard, and Smith, and I'm going to try to say everything within the 15 minutes without reserving time. Would you like me to begin?
Yes.
We are respectfully asking this court to reverse the district court's decision and asking the court to rule that appellant is entitled to subsequent injury reimbursement. Subsequent injury is a statutory method by which employers who can meet statutory requirements can be reimbursed for the verified costs of their workers' compensation claim if they meet the mandates of the statute. The particular statute at issue in this appeal is NRS 616B587. This gives the specific requirements that the employer must meet in order to obtain subsequent injury reimbursement. The particular subsection that is on appeal is subsection 4. The DIR, who initially makes the recommendation after reviewing the subsequent injury binder submission by appellant, found that all mandated requirements were met except subsection 4. Just to refresh recollection for everyone, subsection 4 says that a private carrier must accept...
Don't read these statutes.
All right.
We've got it in front of us, and you'll waste your time.
Thank you.
I'd rather if you would tell us why, what particular knowledge did your client have and when. The report of the DIR suggests that that knowledge was acquired the day after the industrial injury.
That is correct.
Okay. Was the deficiency here that it wasn't in writing in some fashion, or was the deficiency that this knowledge didn't exist before employment began?
The DIR found that the deficiency was that the employer had not proven that the claimant had returned to work full duty, permanent full duty, or permanent modified duty. When it got to the appeals level, that is not the way the appeals officer ruled. He denied it because he interpreted subsection 4 as meaning that the employer has to have not only knowledge of the pre-existing physical impairment, but has to hire and or retain the claimant in employment before the actual subsequent injury. This is not the way the DIR found. The DIR tried to tell the appeals officer that this is not the way that they had been conducting their decisions previously based on an injunction in 1999 from the district court.
But is there a dispute about the facts that your client didn't know about the pre-existing condition when the employee was hired?
No.
Learned about the pre-existing condition the day after the industrial injury that gave rise to the next calculation.
Correct.
Justice Hardesty, let's go back to that secondary point. There seems to be some discrepancy in the record as to that secondary issue. It's clear that the employee did not divulge to Holiday that they had a pre-existing condition when they were hired.
Yes.
There was an injury. What the record seems to conflate a little bit is whether or not the injury we're talking about that they became aware of with knowledge was the secondary injury or the prior injury, and then the scope of that first injury, because it seems that a full evaluation was not done until after the employee separated from employment, which was when Holiday found out the full scope of the actual injury.
Not exactly.
Please clarify then.
All right. The employer found out about the pre-existing injury the day after the industrial injury. Then what happens, or used to happen, is that the employer would send in notice to the DIR, which it did, that there might be a subsequent injury request for reimbursement down the road. Eventually, after the claim was closed, the employer applies for reimbursement from the subsequent injury fund. And at that time, they try to gather as many records as possible to support their position. And this is something that is the regular process for subsequent injury relief. The problem that we have here is that since the late 90s, the DIR, who is able to pass regulations in the Nevada Administrative Code to help interpret how these laws are to be, how procedurally how these laws are to work, has never passed a regulation that explains their interpretation of subsection 4. And so their practice has been, since the late 90s, to allow an employer to gain knowledge after the subsequent injury of the pre-existing condition. And as long as the employer has that knowledge and retains the injured worker in employment, either full-time or permanent modified duty, then for all these years, the DIR has allowed, as long as they have satisfied the other mandates, has allowed reimbursement from the subsequent injury fund. So counting on that, this employer, who we represent, applied, and the only reason, as I stated previously, the DIR denied it was they found that the employee had not been retained in permanent employment. The appeals officer never reached the permanent employment issue because he found what we are here for today.
So the distinction, the DIR says, okay, you can learn about this subsequent injury after the employment and you can retain the employee, but they require that it be retained in a permanent position as opposed to a temporary position.
That is
by practice, not regulation.
That is correct.
That seems to be consistent with what this says. There's no indication in the file that this employer provided permanent modified duty or permanent full duty position to this lady, and that's why they didn't feel four was met.
That is why they denied it. May I comment on that further?
Of course.
All right. The DIR has held the position, as long as I've been doing this for years, that retention means, in the DIR's mind, that the injured worker returns to work full-time in a permanent position for the employer, or if the injured worker is released with permanent modified duties, that the employer retains the employee in that permanent modified position. Lately, they have also indicated that if a employee is retained 6 months or more in a temporary total disability work status, that they would even consider that because it meets with federal laws regarding permanent employment after 6 months. The problem with that is, again, that the appeals officer never reached that decision. At page 233 in the appendix, there is the separation notice that shows that the employer felt that at the time our claimant separated willingly from employment in January of 04, they considered her a full-time employee. It is checked. Full-time employee. She was making the same wage as what she was initially hired. So we only know that she returned as a co-manager with her husband, continued to work, continued to receive her apartment as a benefit, and when she separated, the employer considered her full-time. But the appeals officer didn't reach that decision.
The appeals officer's decision then was based upon the fact that the knowledge required is knowledge of a pre-existing condition before the hire, and seems to have disregarded the application of the retention portion of the statute.
My understanding of the appeals officer's decision is that he said that the knowledge of the pre-existing and the hiring and or retention in employment all have to come before the subsequent injury. Yes.
And that's this case?
Yes, that is.
Okay. Then why should we read this statute as you argue that knowledge of the pre-existing condition before retention doesn't work?
For several reasons. Part of the reason that the appeals officer found that way was based on the legislative history back in 1973. Part of the arguments then included, and this is all in the appendix, included arguments that if we found the way the appeals officer found in this case, the argument was that the employer had to prove this by writing down at the time of hire what the pre-existing condition was. There was a counter-argument that that would not necessarily be fair because an injured employee would be scared to tell an employer about the pre-existing condition at the time of hire. And so the counter-argument was that it would be all right to consider someone being retained after the subsequent injury and the employer writing down about the pre-existing condition as long as the employer continued to employ that employee in light duty. And the reason was because that encouraged employers to cooperate in rehabilitative efforts. That's another reason we believe that light duty means that you've been retained in employment. Then if you look at the purposes for the enactment of the subsequent injury funds, they're twofold. It's up to the states which they choose, but the first one is to hire the disabled. If we look at that alone, that might support, in our opinion, the appeals officer's decision that hiring has to be written down before hiring. However, in addition to hiring, it's supposed to encourage retaining and not firing. So if an employer learns after the subsequent injury about the pre-existing condition, he has reason not to fire this person because he knows he can turn to the subsequent injury fund. The other arguments that were made at that time is that if an employer learns about the pre-existing condition after the subsequent injury, that somehow he's going to be taking advantage of the subsequent injury fund because it's like he knows there's going to be higher workers' comp costs. That's not accurate. In fact, in the appendix, there are studies that show that, one, workers' compensation costs are not, the way they are calculated are based on what type of work the employer does and the experience rating. There's also a study that was done at the U.S. Department of Labor where it showed that they compared 11,000 disabled workers to 10,000 non-disabled persons. The disabled workers, there was hardly any difference in the number of accidents that these people had. And the reason they came to believe that was that the disabled workers had a higher respect for having a job and having fewer accidents. So we feel that the latter argument doesn't work. And I just want to underscore that equitably, it just seems that for 12 years with the DIR, never contesting this, never passing a regulation, that is unfair to current employers who have counted on this for all of these years. And if you read the plain language of the statute, it's very clear in our opinion where it specifically uses the word or in knowledge. And all it says is or retains the injured worker in employment after acquiring such knowledge. It does not say that it has to be before the subsequent injury.
Does the written knowledge requirement extend to retention?
I'm not clear what.
Well, it says you have to establish by written records that the employer had this knowledge.
Well, what that means is that the employer has to have something in writing created at the time that they learned about it that the employee had a pre-existing condition.
So what's in your client's records that establish their knowledge of the pre-existing condition the day after the injury?
I believe it was the MRI that was in the file, and it showed that there was a pre-existing back problem.
Is there a doctor's report or an evaluation, as Justice Douglas mentioned?
Well, the radiologist, whoever interprets his report, shows that there was a prior. Yes, and that is not.
Do you have a record site on that?
I didn't. Let me see.
If not, you can give it to the clerk later.
All right. Yes, I can give it to the clerk. But please remember that that is not. The DIR found that the prior knowledge had been satisfied.
Well, I know the DIR did. The appeals officer rejected that notion.
Well, what he was rejecting again, is that the prior knowledge was obtained at an agreement. I see you understand. All
right. Well, I think I do.
Closing comment?
No, thank you.
All right.
Good morning, Justice Hardesty and Douglas and Perry-Gary. Nancy Wong, Division Counsel, Nevada Division of Industrial Relations, and I'm going to try to remember to speak slowly. I think this is a very straightforward case. I think that the appeals officer, as a de novo trial judge, is entitled to look at the statute independently and to review that. The Division of Industrial Relations, just as a little background, regulates workers' compensation matters. It is in charge of administering the uninsured case, uninsured employer's claim account, and we've had recent cases on that, and our subsequent injury accounts. And the subsequent injury has been in existence since 1973, and I'm sure that you've read the appendix. It has a legislative history about why the subsequent injury accounts were adopted. The purpose primarily was to prevent handicapped workers from being either discriminated by not being hired or being fired once there was knowledge of that impairment, because the old workers' compensation law would require the insurer to pay for the entire claim. So if someone lost one eye, that might be a 25% permanent partial disability award. But if he lost that second eye due to an industrial injury, then he would have a permanent total and his claim would be 100% of this person's disability. So the compromise was, rather than either having people fired or having people, insurers having to pay for the whole claim, was to set up a separate fund that would pay for everything after the subsequent injury was established. They were, in 1973, one claim. Then that was changed in 1995 to State Industrial Insurance System, which was a state fund, and the self-insured employers. And they didn't like having the same fund, because if SIS put in 75% of the money and got 85% of the recovery, then they were saying that the self-insureds were subsidizing the state industrial insurance system. So the legislature carved out two funds. They carved out for the self-insured employers, and they would have a board to hear those cases, and then the state industrial insurance system would hear their matters. The IR,
and that kind of takes us to the injunctive aspect of Fondi's mission and his order, and the distinction that you talked about. How are we to treat that, and how are we to treat the non, it seems, or their assertion that the rule wasn't applied because of the Fondi injunction, appropriately or inappropriately?
Since 1995, the State Industrial, the Division of Industrial Relations had required the retention to occur before the second injury, because that was the only logical reading of that. And this is outside the record, but there was a 3-2 split on that board decision, and three of the people felt that, you know, the purpose is to spread the cost, so it doesn't really matter. We'll spread the cost. Two people didn't. It went to the district court. Judge Fondi, if you read the injunction from 1999, is very clear that it only applies to the self-insured employers board, and the other two boards were not implicated. In fact, the private carrier board was not even established until 1999, July, I believe. And Judge Fondi's order said that it was an injunction on that board only until the Supreme Court reversed it. And I think if we look at the statute itself, I think that Justice Hardesty brought up the point that the written records, that requirement appears to apply to both the hiring, that you know somebody has a back injury at the time of hire, or that you retain it and you still have that written record. The written record in the record on review indicates that we don't want to have people, you know, playing Tuesday morning quarterback and saying, oh yeah, I knew, but you don't have any proof. So that's why we have the written requirement. And if we look at the statute, subsection 4, it says the private carrier must establish by written records that, and then it says that they were hired and they had the knowledge, or that. So I think that that written requirement applies to both sections. And I think that DIR has, in light of the Judge Fondi injunction, been very narrow in reading the statute. But the appeals officer in a de novo situation has the opportunity to read the statute and look at it, its meaning de novo. And if we look
Ms.
at that.
Wong, the way I read the correct me, I'm trying to seek clarification here, but the way I read the appeals officer's decision, it focuses on the absence of a written record of knowledge before the decision to retain.
Correct, and I think that that's what another reading of the statute could be, is that before, in the old days, when people worked for the same company for quite a long time, maybe somebody started a company at 25, was fine, played football on the weekend, twisted a knee, and the employer knew that. The employer retained that person, and then 2 years, 5 years down the road, the person had an industrial injury to that knee. So we have the retention prior to the second injury, not in this case where the woman was hired in 2000, but she'd had the back surgery in 1989. The initial treatment was on the 24th, and the 25th when they did the x-ray, they could obviously see that she'd had surgical scars on the back of her spine, and that the x-ray showed a fusion.
I'd like to test the appeals officer's decision with this question. If the employee sustains an industrial injury while employed, and at least according to the facts of this case, the day afterwards, knowledge of the pre-existing condition is made available to the employer by virtue of the MRI and that report. I'm assuming that the decision to retain the employee, whether in a temporary status or a permanent status, was made then after that, because the employee was injured, they weren't there. The decision wasn't made until after they had knowledge of the MRI. So wouldn't that call into question the appeals officer's decision that there was an absence of written record establishing knowledge prior to the decision to retain?
I think that the retention...
The sequence is what bothers me about the facts of this.
I think the retention issue actually is a red herring. The reason that we have vocational rehabilitation services is that, one, we want to return the injured worker back to work, but two, if the person is employed in a light duty or a modified duty with the same employer, their insurance rates are going to go down because they're not going to have as much vocational rehabilitation training or expenses. And so their reward for retaining someone is by retaining them there and not having increased workers' compensation. If you retain someone, how long are we going to retain them? 6 months? 3 months? I would have retained them except that that person quit. I did a temporary job. It's 2 weeks, 2 hours, 2 minutes.
Well, I acknowledge that that's an important question and probably goes to the definition of the word retained, but the legislature doesn't offer us any insight and there are no regulations defining it. So under the normal course of statutory construction, the court would resort to the definition of retained.
And I think that the court could look at retain and say that you have to retain the person once you have the knowledge, and then you have to have the injury. The Sunday football game, 2 years later, you still have that person in your employ, and the person slips on a piece of, a piece of paper or something on the floor and then injures the knee. And that makes sense, and it's consistent with the legislative scheme and the purpose of the subsequent injury. When you start getting onto that retention after you have the knowledge, we don't have anything written that says I'm going to keep this gentleman or this person on my payroll for 6 months or permanently or anything like that. Plus, that would also, I think, leave the door open to some mischief, because the person could say, well, I'm going to keep them for 6 months.
Well, I can see the consequences of what you're talking about. I guess my question, though, is, and even though those would be harmful to the program and harmful and perhaps even subject to falsification of claims, but the legislature would need to fix that problem, not the court.
The legislature has had several opportunities to repeal the subsequent injury account. They've been looking in 1990, the ADA was enacted, and in 1993, the Senate Legislative Committee recommended the repeal of that. That did not happen. And then the 1997-1999 Legislative Subcommittee had proposed phasing out the subsequent injury, and that didn't happen. It seems like the legislature has been giving the courts quite a bit more power in things like apportionment and budgets and things like that. So I don't know that we're going to get the legislature in their infinite wisdom to pass anything regarding the subsequent injury. I would note in...
Are you suggesting, though, in your argument that the reason that the appeals officer is approaching the statutory interpretation in this way is because of the consequences to the fund resulting from retaining for only a temporary period of time or the uncertainty associated with the length of the retainage?
I think that that could have been one of the appeals officer's considerations. In our brief on page 10, we note that I believe it was the Arizona court was concerned about people buying casualty insurance after the accident or the injury. And our court in the neighbor's case, which had to do with the uninsured claim, had talked about an employer that had an injury that was uninsured and then went and bought insurance really quickly and falsified his prior knowledge of the accident to cover that claim. And the court found that a perpetration of a fraud on the insurance company was not acceptable to that and set aside the insurance company's acceptance of that policy.
Well, counsel, there's still this issue that's bothering me as I'm looking at the State of Nevada Department of Administration before the appeals officer, and at 330, paragraph 4, the conclusions of law, where it states that thus, in order to consider furlough from a second injury account prior to the second injury, the employer has to have either hired or retained the employee with knowledge of the pre-existing impairment, then case cites, and then concludes, knowledge of the second injury is insufficient.
I think that meant timing-wise. And the other concern would be is that, well, I know that someone, you know, has a bad back. Do we know that this person is just, you know, has a pulled muscle, or do we know actually that this person's had some kind of serious impairment to employment, a surgery or some type of thing like that?
I guess what I'm querying is whether or not, based upon this conclusion of law, that he's stating that the only thing they were aware of was this, quote, new injury, not the prior injury, in this conclusion.
The facts on the record indicate that the injured worker was injured on June 13th and did not seek treatment until June 24th. And if you look on that C4 form, actually the physician's assistant didn't even notice a prior condition. And it was the next day when she had an x-ray that the x-ray noticed and observed that there was a fusion. So that's all that the record has and I'm aware of. Are there any other questions? I feel like I've covered everything.
I don't have any other questions, Justice Douglas, but I would like to thank counsel. Great lawyering this morning, and I really appreciate your help. Really good job.
To echo the comments of Justice Hardesty, we thank both counsel for their arguments this morning, shedding light on this, and this is why we ordered it up for oral argument this morning to clarify the record and deal with this wonderful little intricacy in the law. With that, this matter will stand submitted.